This is Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's Dr. Kirk Heinze.
Well, a frequent and always welcome guest on this program is Michigan Senator Debbie Stabenow. Senator Stabenow champions sustainability across a broad spectrum of legislative initiatives ranging from Great Lakes restoration to farmland conservation to alternative energy. And she has a new assignment that is very much linked to all that she has already done in sustainability. Senator, always good to have you on the program.
Well, Kirk, it's always great to be with you to talk about one of my very favorite topics, which is how we protect our precious Great Lakes.
Absolutely. Well, tell us about your new assignment, your new appointment.
Well, we have had in the United States Senate a bipartisan Great Lakes Task Force for a long time, actually all the way back to the 70s. And it's currently chaired by Senator Levin, who we will miss dearly when he retires at the end of the year, and Senator Mark Kirk from Illinois. And to strengthen the commission and then and to get ready for next year, I'm hopeful I'll be taking over as chair. The commission has added two new vice chairs, myself from Michigan and Senator Rob Portman from Ohio. And I think this is important because that then puts not only Michigan, but Illinois and Ohio in the leadership. And what we do is take the lead on all of the funding issues for the Great Lakes, you know, dredging the money for the invasive species. You know, I've led on the issue of Asian carp and will continue to do that. So when you look at the Great Lakes, it's this bipartisan group of senators and House members that decide, you know, when and where to push to make sure we're protecting the Great Lakes.
Well, Senator, I know this is just one of many issues that you just mentioned regarding the Great Lakes, but this one has been very contentious, and you're well aware of it. It's the phosphate issue in Lake Erie, the nutrients that are causing some algal blooms and other environmental problems. The fact that you and Senator Portman are going to be co-vice chairs, does that mean we might see less finger-pointing between Michigan and Ohio and more collaboration on getting this fixed?
Hopefully the answer is yes. I mean, we've got to be working together. And frankly, we've created a new tool. You and I have talked before about the conservation title in the Farm Belt. We're in the process right now of designating what we're calling regional partnerships that can focus on local issues. And Lake Erie is certainly one of those. So, you know, our farmers are engaged. We've got to deal with runoff into the lakes, other quality issues, and so on. And we do that, I think, most effectively with partnerships and funding, sharing the cost of funding to solve the problems. And we do that through the Farm Bill.
Senator, do you find in the Senate, though, by and large, that when it comes to the Great Lakes, there's a lot of bipartisan support for doing the right thing environmentally?
There really is. I mean, I think, you know, certainly for me, for all of us in Michigan, protecting the Great Lakes is in our DNA. You know, it's who we are. But we also have very passionate advocates and supporters all around the Great Lakes, from our friends in Minnesota on one end, you know, all the way over to New York with Lake Ontario on the other end. So this is an area, frankly, where we were able to come together, and we passed a water resources bill not long ago. It became law. And for the first time, we were able to designate a specific percentage of that money to go for dredging of inland lakes. In the past, you know, most of that dredging money goes to places like Seattle and California and New York and Boston and so on. We were able to strengthen the money for the Great Lakes, and that's because we had bipartisan support.
Well, on this program, as you probably well know, we have featured a number of Great Lakes restoration projects that are funded by virtue of your fine efforts. And again, from dredging to invasives to all of those things. And what you said at the beginning is absolutely true. Our Great Lakes are a jewel, a crown jewel, and we have to make sure they're preserved for future generations.
No question about it. And I think we will. And of course, the next one we've got to take huge steps on is Asian carp. We're working in the right direction. We just got to go faster. So I'm really pushing on that.
You mentioned the Farm Bill a couple of times. We had the pleasure of talking with a good friend of yours, Phil Corzine from the Cherry Marketing Institute. Yeah, you got some, there's some supplemental funding that will help some of those fruit producers who were pretty much wiped out in 2012 because of the bad weather, and they're going to get some help retroactively. Tell us about that.
Well, this is really important. This is under the category of disaster assistance. We've traditionally done that for livestock producers and so on when there's drought, but we haven't done it for our fruit growers in the past. So obviously, representing fruit growers, and when I led the effort on the Farm Bill, I wanted to make sure they were included. So 2012, as you mentioned, they basically got wiped out in terms of the cherry growers up north. What happened, it warmed up early in February, March, then it froze again. The buds were already out on the trees, so it wiped out all the fruit. And we also had big losses with our apple growers. We had problems for our grape growers on down in southwest Michigan. But it literally wiped out the cherry growers. So this is incredibly important. We don't want our growers losing the farm because of a few days of bad weather. It's the riskiest business in the world, part of our responsibility, I think, and it's in our best interest as Americans to make sure they have the tools they need to manage risk and to get disaster assistance, and this is going to provide some much-needed help.
I'm talking sustainability with Michigan Senator Debbie Stabenow. Yeah, according to Phil, the cherry growers, at least who he represents, could not be happier and more grateful for the assistance. That's going to help some folks dig out of a pretty deep hole. Let's turn to the new biopesticide plant. Pretty exciting. Down in Bangor, Michigan, Marone, Michigan Manufacturing. There's a little story behind that because I think you actually went to California, right, to check this out before this company established a subsidiary in Michigan.
I did, Kirk. This is one of those situations that, you know, it happens to me all the time where I run into businesses in other states and I say, you should be in Michigan. And sometimes they take me up on it, which is great. In this case, as part of my duties getting ready to write the Farm Bill, I was invited out to look at agriculture in California. And as we were traveling, because of my interest in research and bioresearch, it had been recommended that I stop in and take a look at this research facility. And I was told it was this dynamic woman, Pam Marone, who was doing this, what's called biopesticide research, which means instead of using chemicals, they use bugs and insects and grasses and all kinds of, you know, biomaterial, which is, of course, better for the environment, better for runoff into the lakes and so on. And so I stopped and looked at the facility. I was really blown away with what she was doing, and she mentioned that they were getting ready to actually produce the biopesticides, and they were looking at something more in the middle of the country as a place to do it. And, of course, I immediately said, Michigan. And so we worked with her. I helped her identify a plant that had been closed, a biodiesel plant, in southwest Michigan. And they took a look at it, said it was perfect for them. And so we officially had the ribbon cutting just about a month or so ago. It's starting out with about 50 jobs and growing from there. So it's pretty exciting.
Well, in one dimension, I was reading a little bit about some of their innovations, but they're also in some R&D, at least, on what's called, I think, a molluscicide, which actually may impact things like zebra mussels, a pesticide, an organic pesticide that actually knocks out mollusks like zebra mussel. That's pretty incredible.
It is incredible. In fact, I think she and I really connected when she started talking about that when I originally met her, and I started talking to her about the Great Lakes and how critical this was. And I said, you know, if you're producing those kinds of biochemicals, you need to be right next to the Great Lakes and show that it's effective. So they are, in fact, producing this. I think it will be on the market pretty soon, hopefully.
Well, what an interface this company is between agriculture, water quality, and sustainability. I mean, it's almost a paradigm example.
It's wonderful. And, you know, I really believe that the intersection of agriculture and manufacturing is where a lot of the future jobs are, innovations are. It's not only biofuels, it's what we call bio-based manufacturing, which for the first time we put into the energy title in the Farm Bill. I had rolled out something called a Grow It Here, Make It Here initiative. We put it into the Farm Bill. And that just means whether it's bio-based pesticides that are better for the water and the environment and so on, in terms of pesticides, or whether it's using soy oil or corn byproducts or wheat byproducts or whatever it is to replace petroleum and chemicals. There's a lot that's going on that creates jobs in Michigan. It's better for the environment. A lot of it's biodegradable. I mean, we create these ways to, you know, chainsaw lubricants or soap or shampoo or there's some folks in Lansing that are doing a corn-based, basically it's styrofoam, but instead of using petroleum, it's corn byproducts, and it's used for packaging. Looks exactly like styrofoam. The difference is it's biodegradable. No landfill. You put water on it, it biodegrades. So that's the future, and it's creating jobs. And as chair of the Ag Committee, we recently did a big hearing on this and invited 35 companies in from around the country to show what they were doing, including several in Michigan. And I think it's very exciting.
Senator, I have one last question here for you, and we may have to cover it in more detail and during a future interview, which I would love to do. But as you know, the EPA recently announced a plan to cut carbon dioxide emissions from our power plants by 30% from 2005 levels. There's quite a bit of pushback on that, and I know this has to be finalized in each state, but there are even those in agriculture who claim that that's going to push up their energy costs. You know, that was the same argument when we did our renewable portfolio standards before, and actually, with wind energy, those costs came down. So we're hearing the same old arguments about why not to do something we should be doing.
Well, first let me say carbon dioxide is a poison, just like anything else. We've dealt with other things before in terms of air pollution. We've got to deal with this for many reasons in terms of, as well. Certainly what's happening is it makes the climate more volatile, and we're spending billions of dollars on disaster assistance alone in agriculture because of the fact that we're not solving this. But we also can do it in a way that's flexible. I think what's important, the EPA's given the responsibility to each state to come up with a plan that works for them. So we've got to make sure this works for Michigan. But it's absolutely true that with our technology and know-how, you know, we're number one in the country in new clean energy patents. So the new ideas are coming from Michigan. The bio-based economy solves this, and it helps create jobs. All the things I was just talking about help solve that problem of carbon pollution, but at the same time creates jobs. So this is not about losing jobs. It's about innovating and creating more jobs. So that's what I'm focused on.
Again, you mentioned the interface between agriculture and manufacturing and the environment. Well, what about the interface, of course, between economic development and what's good for the environment? And you're certainly a champion of all of those things. I've been talking with Senator Debbie Stabenow about sustainability. And again, Senator, congratulations on your new appointment as Vice Chair of the Senate Great Lakes Task Force.
Thanks so much. Look forward to talking to you again soon.
That was Dr. Kirk Heinze with Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. There's more online at mlive.com/environment.
I'm Scott Westerman from the MSU Alumni Association. Whether you're moving across town or across the country, relocating to a new job or a new city is always a challenge. When you join the MSU Alumni Association family, wherever you go, you'll have an instant circle of friends on hand to help you get settled and get connected. With more than 100 clubs and affiliates around the world, there's a Spartan in just about every city. And as an MSU Alumni Association member, you'll quickly feel right at home. Wherever you go, community, connections, careers, and class, four great reasons to visit alumni.msu.edu today to activate your membership in the largest Spartan organization in the world. That's alumni.msu.edu, the Michigan State University Alumni Association, your personal network for life.
This is Greening of the Great Lakes, inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's Dr. Kirk Heinze.
Well, Michigan is home to a company that has manufactured several, over the past many years, Final Four basketball courts and regional final basketball courts for the NCAA. It's also a company that puts environmental stewardship front and center. The company is Connor Sports, located in Amasa, Michigan, in the Upper Peninsula, and we welcome back to the program Jason Gasparich, who is the Director of Sustainability, and he's going to tell us about a sports industry sustainability roundtable that he was recently part of. Jason, nice to talk to you again.
Hey, thanks for having me back again.
Before we get into the roundtable, tell us, remind our listeners a little bit about your company, what it is that you do, and your history working with the NCAA.
Yeah, so Connor Sports has been around for a few years. We were actually founded in 1872. So actually, we've been in business longer than the game of basketball has been around. And we our primary business is manufacturing basketball courts. You know, many other types of sports surfacing as well, but primary business, again, is basketball courts using Michigan maple.
Mm-hmm. And what about the Final Four and regional final courts? So you've been doing that for years now. That's, you know, that's high clover, as they say.
It is. It's a project that we've taken on a number of years ago, and it's something that we really look forward to, and the town really celebrates it. It's certainly a source of pride for many of the employees that are at the mill and their families that live in the surrounding communities.
And in 2015, where's the Final Four going to be?
Indianapolis.
So you guys are rolling already on that, I suppose.
We're working on it.
Okay. Jason, you were a part, and your company is no stranger to being green. I mean, you folks have got an amazing track record of sustainability. But you were recently part of a Green Sports Alliance Summit. Tell our listeners a little bit about the summit and the purpose of it and your involvement.
Well, the Green Sports Alliance is a group that's relatively new. This is their fourth year in existence. And their primary focus is to bring together professional sports teams, collegiate sports teams, facility managers, league representatives, and manufacturers to try to collaborate and share with each other what groups are doing that might work to make their facilities a little more sustainable, save some money, and do things good by the environment.
We just talked to one of our guests about a recent sustainability report that was put out by the National Hockey League, which showcased a lot of the things. This whole business of being green in sports is a growing phenomenon. Again, Connor Sports has been at this green thing for a long time, but what do you see in the sports industry in general? What are the trends?
I think in general what people have recently realized is that the sports industry can be a conduit to reach out to kids and to families. And to show people why sustainability is important, and maybe to show them the path to being more green. Mm-hmm. You know, people follow sports, people understand sports, and it's a good medium to get the word out there.
Well, the topics at this summit were wide ranging. Certainly, everything from recycling to lighting to what have you. What are some of the, from your perspective, what are some of the really cool things that are happening in sports on the sustainability front?
You know, some of the things that have really been pretty incredible are, I think, the different sources of power that are being used, you know, solar power, wind power, you know, things like that are really cutting down on the facility's energy usage. But, you know, what they're also doing is they're allowing these facilities to get closer to being a net zero carbon footprint, which to me is really exciting. I mean, if you can get a facility to have zero impact on the environment, you know, through these events that bring in, you know, sometimes 70, 80,000 people, now you're really talking about something pretty big.
Well, and on college campuses, I can't speak so much for professional sports, but there's a lot of pressure from the student body, from faculty, from alumni, not just to win basketball and football games, et cetera, but also to be sustainable. So you've got all of those dynamics coming together.
Definitely. You know, I think the general public and the consumers in general are really starting to understand what sustainability means and to demand that from, you know, whatever group they might be following, whether it's a sports, you know, team, you know, college team or professional team. It's almost expected at this point that those individuals, those groups are doing everything they can to lighten the impact on the environment through their events.
And we've talked to people in the athletic departments at University of Michigan, Michigan State, and some other places, but even the student athletes are getting involved in campus sustainability initiatives. So you've even got the athletes that are putting pressure on administration to do the right thing.
Yes. That's a good point. You know, that's another thing that the Green Sports Alliance is really starting to look at now is, you know, they really have buy-in from the teams and the leagues, but what they need now is they need support of the professional and collegiate athletes. Because those are the, you know, while people might follow a specific team, people really will do what their favorite athlete is doing. So, you know, if their favorite athlete is buying this particular pair of shoes, it's very likely that that kid might go out and want those same shoes. Well, if their favorite athlete, you know, is driving a fuel-efficient vehicle or is recycling, you know, or any number of other things, they're more likely to do that.
It's kind of the phenomenon. If they're wearing pink shoes or pink bats for breast cancer or what have you, then people pay a lot more attention when they're actually demonstrating that on the playing field.
Exactly.
My guest is Jason Gasparich. He is the Director of Sustainability for Connor Sport, located in the Upper Peninsula. Jason, we were talking about an initiative that the Green Sports Alliance is going to do during the NCAA tournaments, I think down in Indianapolis, coming up, in March?
Yeah.
March 2015?
Exactly.
Tell us about it.
What we're going to do, and last year we ran a pilot program in San Joaquin County in California. We worked with three schools and collected recycled materials, which were then, you know, those materials offset the plastics that were used in the men's Final Four court last year. And so what we're looking to do this year is to expand that program. We're going to be working with approximately 20 schools in the Indianapolis area. And those students in those elementary and middle schools are going to be collecting recycled materials, polypropylene especially, which would be plastic bottle caps, yogurt containers, cottage cheese containers, right, things like that. Mm-hmm. And the idea is they're going to offset, again, all of the plastics that are used in the final court. So what the idea of this program is, you know, these kids are going to be throwing their recyclables into a container, and this is going to show them what happens to those materials. So there's no mystery anymore, you know. Instead of throwing that thing in the container and wondering what happens to it and wondering why it's important to recycle, they're going to see it firsthand because, you know, their product is going to be shown on national television. So definitely a way to generate some excitement around the recycling.
What we found is that the kids then will go home, and if the parents aren't doing the recycling, the kids are going to start putting pressure on the parents to do the right thing. Tell us a little bit again about the Green Sports Alliance. Who are some of the members? I mean, would these include professional sports teams or mostly input suppliers or all of the above?
You know what? It's actually mostly teams and leagues. Very few manufacturers and suppliers are involved. The manufacturer and supply chain that is involved in the Green Sports Alliance is typically in the serviceware side of the business, you know, forks, knives, cups, plates, things like that. We are, you know, our involvement is actually kind of unusual in that group because we're the only company that manufactures a product such as ours that is involved. But we feel that it's an important group to be involved in because they're really, you know, they're key people in their respective organizations. And they understand what we do. And by us being involved, it helps us understand what they do. And it allows us all to kind of work together and to, you know, make things better. You know, it allows us all to understand what the needs might be and make changes maybe to our manufacturing process or our shipping methods to reduce impacts to meet, you know, the organizational goals. When you see a group like the NHL putting out a sustainability report, you know, we know what some of their impacts are now because they've done this study. And we can tailor our products to that organization based on shipping methods and things that we're doing at the plant up in AMISA to again, you know, we know what their current numbers are and we know what their goals might be. So we can work together then and reduce those impacts on the environment.
Well, to your point about the idea of the alliance, if you leverage all of these different organizations and franchise and what have you, as opposed to trying to leverage individual brands here and there, and have a lot more impact, like the program you talked about with the kids in Indianapolis.
Right, exactly. It makes a big difference. It's all about collaboration.
Well, tell us about some of the similar sorts of things that you folks have done at Connor Sports up in the Upper Peninsula with the local communities.
Well, one of the things that I haven't mentioned yet, but along with this Recycle to the Final Four program that we're gonna run, which is again, like you'd mentioned, it's tied in with the Center for Green Schools Green Apple Day of Service. We're gonna run a program in September up in AMISA. The local school district, Forest Park School District, has a school forest. They have a stand of hard maple that just happens to be ready for harvest. So we're gonna run a day of service project in that forest. We're gonna bring in students from schools up to 60 miles around, and we're gonna run what's known as a log-a-load program, which is it's an organization, or it's an event hosted by the Great Lakes
Log a load, basically.
And it's a load to say. It's the Great Lakes Timber Producers Association.
Okay.
And what's pretty interesting about that is there's a load of logs that are going to be created during this event, and students are going to learn about responsible harvesting methods and what forestry really is. And typically that load of lumber is then sold to a sawmill, and it goes on its way and it's made into some sort of a product. Well, we're going to do something kind of unique this year. We're going to take that load of lumber and we're going to incorporate it into the men's final court. So not only are we incorporating these recycled materials in reducing the impacts from using recycled plastic collected down in Indianapolis, we're also going to get the local community involved and help them, you know, ask them to help us supply the wood for that floor.
That's fabulous. I'm talking with Jason Gasparich, who's the Director of Sustainability for Connor Sports in the Michigan's Upper Peninsula. But are the kids then going to be able to actually see what you do in terms of developing the floor as well, so they can kind of see it, you know, we used to say from the farm field to the fork, from the forest to the floor kind of
Yeah,
thing?
So that's the part that's really pretty exciting about this process is we're working very closely with the Forest Stewardship Council. In fact, I have a conference call with them tomorrow. What we're looking to do is most people have heard of Google Earth and that technology where you can go to Google and do the street view,
right,
which you can look
Absolutely.
At your house.
You can look at your own house right in the windows.
Exactly. Well, Google has a new technology
Keep your blinds
out there.
On. Yeah, right.
their new technology is called Google Trekker. So they took the cameras that you would typically see on the Google car, they mounted them in a backpack. And the Forest Stewardship Council just recently published the first video of a redwood stand. So they actually put this backpack on and they went through a redwood forest and showed people what a redwood, an FSC certified redwood forest looks like. What we're going to do is we're going to try to get that technology up to AMHSA. We're going to run through the hard maple stand and show people what a responsibly harvested forest looks like and show the harvesting process all on Google Trekker. We're going to follow that floor through the whole manufacturing process using Google Trekker.
Oh, that's
when
fabulous.
This project is all done, you're going to be able to go to the Google homepage, go to Google Earth, and you're going to be able to go through
and we're talking about anybody.
Anybody in the world. You're
going
to be able to walk through the forest, through the manufacturing plant, and follow that floor through the tour all the way down to Indianapolis.
That's fabulous. That is absolutely fabulous. Using modern technology, communications technology to teach sustainability.
Yes.
What are some of the challenges for some of these professional sports companies from your perspective, Jason, particularly, you know, NHL, NFL, Major League Baseball, NBA, what have you, in terms of sustainability?
Well, anytime you bring a large number of people into a small space, you have several different impacts that you need to think about. You know, all those people are getting to that game somehow. Massive transportation impacts. So there's a new focus on, you know, how do we reduce, you know, those impacts? Well, it's going to be promoting public transportation, for example. You know, maybe installing additional bike racks and making that area of the stadium, you know, maybe a little easier to navigate with a bike.
Or maybe you put a stadium like Camden Yards right in the middle of a neighborhood instead of putting it out in the boondocks.
Exactly, yes. Yeah, location is very key. So that's a big concern. You know, the other thing is water usage. You know, how many times, you know, does someone wash their hands? How many times does a toilet get flushed during the course of a game when you have 70 or 80,000 people? How do you reduce the water? You know, well, you can put low flow fixtures in, and that certainly helps. But there are other things. They can reclaim water. You know, they can collect rainwater and store it on the rooftop in tanks and use that to, you know, for flushing toilets, for example. And again, you can really drastically cut the water.
I imagine this could even extend into, for your concessions, getting locally produced food instead of shipping it in from, you know, I mean, the whole gamut of sustainability.
Exactly. And that was something that was really evident last week at the Green Sports Alliance Summit in Santa Clara. The entire event, all of the meals were provided by local vendors, which is exactly what, you know, they're looking for their leagues and teams to do.
Of course, easy to do that in California, right, which is the most agriculturally diverse state.
Yes.
It might be in Iowa.
Yeah, but, exactly.
But still, there are opportunities.
There are certainly opportunities, yes.
Well, you know, Connor Sport being a leader for so many years in sustainability, I mean, this is a sort of a sweet spot for you folks. Are other organizations sort of catching up? I mean, is this something that's going to be sustained over time? I would imagine, as long as it makes economic sense, why not? Huh?
Yeah, we're seeing that. You know, more and more manufacturers, more and more organizations are going, you know, the sustainable direction.
Mm-hmm.
You know, certainly we were the first in our industry, and there are many things that we do where we're the only ones in our industry doing these things. But, you know, with, you know, over time, again, the consumers are going to demand it.
Yeah. Well, I've been talking with Jason Gasparich, who is the Director of Sustainability for Connor Sports. They're a zero-waste company, a leader in sustainability in their industry. And we've been talking about green initiatives in the great world of sport, where sport and sustainability are coming together in unprecedented new ways. Jason, thanks so much for being on Greening of the Great Lakes.
You're very welcome.
That was Dr. Kirk Heinze with Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. There's more online at mlive.com/environment.
Hi, it's Scott Westerman from the MSU Alumni Association. We've all heard the expression, it's all about who you know. And wherever you are on your career ladder, having a friend on the inside can make all the difference. When you join the MSU Alumni Association family, you're instantly connected to 500,000 Spartans around the world, many of whom are key decision makers in just about every major enterprise. Whether you're looking for a way in or a way up, your MSU Alumni Association affiliation can help you link up with that MSU alum who'll always take your call just because you're a Spartan. Building your network right now before you need it is the best possible career insurance, and joining the MSU Alumni Association is the best possible way to get the most out of your Spartan life. Learn more online at alumni.msu.edu. That's alumni.msu.edu. The MSU Alumni Association, your personal network for life.
This is Greening of the Great Lakes, inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's Dr. Kirk Heinze.
Although the topic is not a particularly pleasant one, the eradication of wild hogs in Michigan is important for a number of environmental, economic, and public health reasons. Here to talk to us about the Michigan Wild Hog Removal Program and why it's so important is a frequent guest on this program, Sam Hines. Sam is the Executive Vice President of the Michigan Pork Producers Association. And first-time guest, Dr. Pat Ruz, Director of Wildlife Programs for the Michigan Wildlife Conservancy. Pat, let's start with you, if we could. Tell us about the Michigan Wild Hog Removal Program and why it's so important to all of us in Michigan.
Well, the key to getting rid of hogs wherever they show up is quick action. And we decided in 2010 that we were probably already behind the eight ball a little bit in getting started with a program to reduce wild hog populations. We were, at that point, knowledgeable about maybe 8-10 counties that had pretty large-scale problems with wild hogs, and we wanted a program that we could implement right away. The Michigan Wild Hog Removal Program is geared mainly towards trapping, which is the easiest type of eradication or reducing method that we have. Some of the others arguably could be more effective, for example, the use of dogs, but you know, you're looking at Michigan's mix of private and public lands, and the fact that most of the hogs right now are on private lands, we opted to push a trapping program right from the get-go.
Let's give our listeners a little background. They may not be familiar with the wild hog issue, but what's the problem with these wild hogs, and how did the problem develop?
Well, the problem started in Michigan around 2001. We had the first documented escapes of wild hogs from game ranches and other fence facilities. And the number of hogs that escaped started to increase pretty dramatically over the next 3 or 4 years. Now, these weren't necessarily just a few hogs trickling out now and then through a hole in the fence, but sometimes they were pretty major releases of 50 to 100 animals in some cases. And when they got out, word got around real fast. A lot of people were chasing them around. They wised up real fast, and they started to scatter around. And those kinds of large-scale releases are where we're seeing most of the hogs today. That's where they stemmed from.
Now, so our listeners are clear, these wild hogs were not of domestic origin. Most of them are of Eurasian descent. Is that correct?
Yeah, that was always the case from the get-go when the first one started to escape from the facilities. It's still the case today. We have caught in traps or looked at animals that hunters have taken during the deer seasons, for example, and there are a few hybrids in there. We think we kind of know what facilities those came from. Because not all the game ranches had just purebred Eurasian wild boars, but no matter how you measure it, the hogs that we have been able to see on trail camera and the hogs that have been taken by hunters or trappers, those are pretty close to 100% Eurasian wild boars.
Now, Sam Hines, Executive Vice President of Michigan Pork Producers Association, these wild hogs do some very serious damage to habitat, but they can also devastate the domestic hog industry.
Well, that's correct, Kirk. Our interest in this from the outset was the possibility of them spreading diseases, some of which we've eradicated from the domestic swine herd, and we knew that wild hogs had or carried. The concern was them transferring those diseases to the domestic herd. So we immediately got very concerned about it as we learned that more and more of them were proliferating around the state in different areas. And our producers said, you know, we need to get engaged and try to do what we can to, you know, to stop this or to try to get it under control.
One of those diseases, if I'm correct, is one that really constituted one of the great animal industry research accomplishments of the last century. That was the eradication of a disease called pseudorabies, which was, as I understand it, essentially eliminated from the domestic hog. These animals carry pseudorabies or the potential to, what, reintroduce pseudorabies?
They do, and in fact, we have trapped some that have tested positive for pseudorabies. Some years ago, there were a number of them found, and those, you know, the state actually went in and eliminated them as best they could. But yes, we had a great success. We started in 1989. Pseudorabies is not something, it sounds horrendous, but it's not something that people need to worry about. The disease doesn't transfer to people, but it is devastating to hogs in particular. And we began a nationwide eradication effort in 1989 and completed that in 2005. So for all intents and purposes, the disease was totally eradicated from the domestic swine herd and actually was eradicated from the Michigan herd in 2001.
And just think of the millions of dollars that were spent to eradicate that disease, and now we have the potential with these animals to bring it back. Pat, in addition to what Sam has talked about in terms of the impact on the hog industry, what do these critters, you're an expert in wildlife ecology, what do these critters do in terms of wildlife habitat and some of the Michigan's precious wildlife species?
Well, absolutely nothing that's good. Wild hogs are very destructive to the ground and to vegetation. They have a rooting behavior, just like domestic pigs. And if they want something with a calorie in it or two, they're going to go get it. And you know, their rooting is really legendary. Myself, I've seen it down in Florida as deep as 2 feet, and here in Michigan, you know, not quite as deep. But the scars of some of the areas that were rooted up in 2005, 2006 are still there today when I revisit those sites. The ground doesn't heal up. The vegetation changes. I've seen crop fields, for example, a 40-acre bean field totally wiped out. Large areas of winter wheat, 10, 15, 20 acres at a time, just gone. Rototilled up, it would appear from somebody who didn't realize that it was hogs that did the damage. So those kinds of impacts, that's the visible sort of thing. The invisible impacts that you don't recognize come in form of predation. They are a predator. I know people think they're a bean and corn eater, but the wild hogs that we have running around take a fair number of deer fawns and pretty much anything that they can catch and get in their mouth. And so those kinds of impacts have been studied in other states, but not so much in Michigan. We really don't know what what exactly they're impacting, but boy, there are some concerns. Back in the mid 2000s, around 2005 and 6, a number of wild hogs moved into some of the Kirtland's warbler breeding areas up in northern Michigan, and that has created a lot of concerns. They don't seem to be in there in great numbers now, but that's the sort of thing you just wonder, you know, whether they can have an impact on an endangered species like that. There's a whole myriad of concerns about wild hogs when they get in the landscape, and none of this is conjecture. I mean, sometimes when an invasive exotic species comes in, you're not really quite sure what's going to happen, and scientists want to take a slow and steady approach to finding out what's going on. We don't have to do that with wild hogs. I mean, we know what they're going to do. We have history of wild hogs in more than 36 states across the globe, you know, from India to Australia to Hawaii, and we know what they do, and it's all destructive.
And Sam had mentioned earlier that these critters can transmit diseases to the domestic hog population, which poses a severe threat to our pork industry. Can they also transmit diseases to other wildlife?
Well, they can. There haven't, to my knowledge, there aren't too many areas in the world where they're, you know, very concerned about those other diseases. They do impact dogs. In some areas, especially dogs that are used to hunt them. You know, they are capable of spreading other diseases.
I would just follow up on that a little bit. Just recently, there's a disease we don't have in the U.S. called African swine fever, which is terribly devastating to the pork industry. And we do know with certainty that that's being spread in certain areas around the world by wild hogs. So hopefully we'll never get it here, but that is a concern.
Sam, the Michigan Wild Hog Removal Program, essentially the genesis of that was when Michigan finally decided to declare these wild hogs invasive species. That was not as easy a process as it might seem, given what you guys have said about the virulence of this animal. But a little background on that. I mean, it took some doing by organizations that you both represent and many others to get that done.
Well, it did. Most of agriculture came together realizing that this was a problem not only for the livestock industries, but also for cropping and for the rest of agriculture. So we came together and really worked hard to try to get the department to declare them an invasive species. And that ultimately happened. That then eliminated them from being possible to have. So you know, we kind of viewed this as a two-pronged problem. Number one, we knew that many of these, this whole problem sort of emanated from the escapes from some of the hunting preserves. So making it illegal to have them stopped that. It kind of shut the faucet off, so to speak. But as Dr. Ruz has indicated, there are still a population of them in the wild, and so we still have to be concerned about that. And whatever we can do to mitigate that population. And, you know, some of the experts we've talked to say that you have to take 70% of them out to just to stabilize the population, and that's no small task. So it is a concern, but most of our focus recently has been on the wild hog trapping program or anything to try to mitigate the numbers to some extent.
Well, Pat, again, let's go back to the removal program more specifically. Our listeners out there might be wondering, okay, if I find that I have the presence of wild hogs on my property or suspect that I do, what exactly should they do?
Well, probably the first thing that they ought to do is contact either the Michigan Wildlife Conservancy, or preferably they can go directly to the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Wildlife Services branch. That's the unit that deals with problem wildlife, and also is related to the people who track diseases around the country. The Michigan Wild Hog Removal Program is actually a program that was started with the Conservancy and USDA. Later, some other partners evolved, and so it is a program where there's a bit of coordination, but it's actually just one prong and kind of a multi-agency and multi-group thrust to try to deal with the whole problem. And as Sam indicated, it's really a two-part thing, getting rid of the hogs that are already out there, and then secondly, making sure that no more are released into the wild. And the DNR has been very active on that end in trying to create and enforce a ban on bringing additional wild hogs into the state. By the way, most of those wild hogs we're dealing with today are not Michigan born and bred. They were brought in from Canada.
For people who may, these are ferocious looking animals. I mean, the brochure that you folks have just put out in cooperation with the Michigan Farm Bureau and the Mauser Harmony with Nature Foundation, and there are pictures of these critters, and they are ferocious. Some folks may not feel comfortable being anywhere near them or getting involved in trapping, or they don't want anything to do with that part of it, but they want to help get rid of them. So what then?
Well, if they contact USDA Wildlife Services and they can verify that they've got hogs on their property, that there's some hope of holding there long enough to trap, USDA will come in, lend a trap. There's some training available online. If you go to the Michigan Wildlife Conservancy website, for example, there's some training there. They get some background, but we don't, through the program, just drop a trap off and leave, but there's an education and instructional aspect of it. The last 2 years, I met with landowners at 17 different sites around the state and help to educate them, hopefully, about not only the problem, but the nuts and bolts of how you get rid of those things. It's not rocket science, but it takes some work. And so there has to be a commitment and a belief that they're doing something worthwhile. A lot of people think it's a great program and they hope their neighbors get involved, but not them.
Well, and as Sam mentioned, you're going to need about a 70% eradication in order to get this thing under control. I know it's devastating to hogs and other wildlife. I can't even imagine what would happen if my golden retriever ran into a sounder of these things. It would not be very pleasant. We've been talking about the Michigan Wild Hog Removal Program. And it's a program that listeners can help. You can find more information about it by going to any number of websites. You can go to certainly the Michigan Wildlife Conservancy website, the Michigan Pork Producers Association website, Michigan Department of Agriculture, and several other places. Probably best is just Google the Michigan Wild Hog Removal Program. My guests have been Dr. Pat Ruzz, Director of Wildlife Programs for the Michigan Wildlife Conservancy, and Sam Hines, the Executive Vice President of the Michigan Pork Producers Association. Sam and Pat, thanks so much for being on Greening of the Great Lakes.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
That was Dr. Kirk Hinesy with Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. There's more online at mlive.com/environment.
I'm Scott Westerman from the MSU Alumni Association with another observation from the Spartan Life. One of the things that drives me nuts about Facebook is how people complain about stuff there. Not that I'm against complaining. I actually love it. If there is a solution and the willingness to engage in creating that solution attached to it. It's hard to change the status quo on anything because entrenched organizations are just that. Well-organized. They have someone in charge and a large infrastructure behind them that is well-paid to keep things as they are. They have studied the rules of the game, know their competition, have plans in place to protect their position. And here's the biggest factor. They are dedicated to the cause. If the past decade has taught us anything, it's that most people are basically comfortably numb, lethargic, and short of complaining on Facebook, are unwilling to get in the game. Entrenched, well-organized operations count on this. They work harder and longer, knowing that most people won't go the distance to fight to the finish. In a pinch, they will give just enough to defang the opposition, but more likely they will create a climate of fear, uncertainty, and doubt about change, and spend lots and lots of time and money to protect their position. Affecting change takes time, commitment to the cause, and the willingness to lead. And it's risky,
We tend to attack charismatic leaders we don't agree with. Take a strong position and your semi-comfortable existence is in danger. It's easy to become demoralized, intimidated, afraid, and it's very easy to give up. So the majority of us just let it ride. We'll yell at the TV, flame the social media comment sections, maybe even get some friends together for lunch for a group gripe. But we won't do anything meaningful with the intensity and tenacity it takes to effect change. So what's the flip side of all of this? Engage, organize, execute, be willing to take some punches, and keep on keeping on. One of my politician friends tells me, nothing frightens me more than a rational constituent on the other side of my argument. Occasionally there will be something that will so inflame enough people that change occurs, but that's rare. Change, wrote Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., does not roll on the wheels of inevitability, but comes through continuous struggle, and so we must straighten our backs and work for our freedom. A man can't ride you unless your back is bent. Margaret Mead's motivational chestnut has become a cliche, but it's still as valid today as it was when she first said it. Never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens can change the world. Indeed, it's the only way that it ever has. The enemy, your competition, the status quo, is counting on the fact that you won't commit to do whatever it takes to get what you want. Will you? I'm Scott Westerman from the MSU Alumni Association. Learn more about Spartans Helping Spartans at alumni.msu.edu.
This is MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
Doug Bueller leads MSU Ag Bioresearch.
MSU Ag Bioresearch is really located strategically within Michigan State University, and we concentrate on research in agriculture, natural resources, and energy.
MSU Ag Bioresearch is changing the face of science.
Our mission really is wise use of the resources, both human and natural resources, and also to protect the productivity and profitability of our natural resource and agricultural systems.
More than 300 scientists from six MSU colleges are leading innovation in food, natural resources, and energy.
Well, I think the most important thing we do is to continue to try to develop production systems that can put safe food on our plates, but also protect the environment and also a situation where the producers can make a good living and protect their resources at the same time.
MSU Ag Bioresearch, leading innovation in food, natural resources, and energy.
Thank you for listening to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. To hear this show again, please click on the local tab at WKAR.org and scroll to MSU Today every Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock on AM 870 WKAR.